Sahrawi actually fought against the Spanish colonization. And when they get rid of actually the Spanish colonization, then immediately after that, and when there was an agreement, especially in the 1975 afterwards, when there was an agreement with Mauritania, which was claiming part of the Western Sahara, that's when actually the monarchy in Morocco, I'm not talking about the people of Morocco. The people of Morocco deserve our respect because we know that they stand also for dignity and justice. But the government, especially the monarchy of Morocco, actually occupied in place of the Spanish colonization, the Western Sahara. And it was normal for Algeria. As I was saying previously, Algeria always stood with the African people for their freedom. So it was normal for the Algerian government to stood with the Polisario.
Spain is in a complicated situation because while it shares borders and strong economic ties with Morocco, it also depends partly on Algeria for natural gas. Spain's move to publicly recognize Morocco's plan to grant Western Sahara region autonomy is seen by analysts as a way of regaining control of its former colony.
Actually, the Spanish who was colonizing Western Sahara, and when they get kicked out by the resistance, the brave resistance of the Sahrawi people and the Polisario movement, they actually resort to ask the Moroccan monarchy to reoccupy Western Sahara and play the dirty interest, if we can say, of the Spanish colonization.
The European Union urged Algeria to reverse its decision, pressing for dialogue to resolve the dispute. Joseph Borrell, the High Representative of the European Union for Foreign Affairs, says Algeria is an important partner for the EU in the Mediterranean and has expressed hope that a swift solution will be found to fully re-establish commercial and investment relations between Algeria and Spain. Now, do you see a resolution soon, especially considering the fact that Europe needs Algeria's gas in view of the current dispute with Russia over the Ukraine crisis?
The EU position when it comes to Algeria is actually, it only shows the arrogance of this former colonizing power. And it's an arrogance, actually, that doesn't have, because if we remember maybe a 100 years ago, maybe this country were military powerful. Economically also, they were maybe a strong country, which is not the case today. What we are witnessing, it's actually a proud African country, Algeria, who is actually showing restraint and who is actually calling for dialogue to solve some of the problem, which should be the norm when it comes to international relation. And then you have the EU who actually is threatening Algeria and saying, no, you shouldn't actually call for a dialogue. You should just accept what we are dictating upon you. This will not work.
As Algeria moves away from Spain, it is enhancing ties with Russia amid the Ukraine conflict. Algiers abstained during a vote on an anti-Russia resolution at the United Nations General Assembly in March on the crisis in Ukraine. During his visit to Algeria in May, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the two countries are preparing a new strategic agreement.
We have confirmed today our mutual interest in preparing a new strategic document between our states, which will mark the passage of cooperation to a higher level.
And now my last question. Will the current crisis between Algeria and Spain move Algiers closer to Moscow?
I definitely hope that the current crisis that was instigated by the EU in order to humiliate another African country that played a historical role in the liberation of the African continent, meaning Algeria, will fail. and that this current crisis, a totally fabricated crisis, will actually let the Algerian government, the Algerian people, and the Algerian leadership actually to definitely turn the page of collaboration with a former colonizer that are actually sinking. They choose actually to go down in the history with the U.S. imperialism. So today, another choice is available for many African countries. And Algeria, like in the past, can show a leadership for many African countries by allying and strengthening their collaboration with the Russian government.
Well, there you have it. The meddling by Western powers will lead many African countries to embrace Russia. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The militaristic and imperialist foreign policy of the United States has negative consequences for every aspect of life in the U.S. and abroad. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Sam Corylinder
and Olivia Donocci, writers. This article is published under the heading Negative Consequences of Boundless U.S. Militarism and Imperialism. Here's the details. In recent years, the U.S. has seen great numbers of people and mass movements take to the streets to challenge the status quo. While domestic outrage grows, resistance to the U.S. war machine remains limited. Even as President Joe Biden is looking to pass a military budget of $813 billion. This bloated budget proposal comes as inflation makes basic products unaffordable and funds for the ongoing pandemic are gutted. The militaristic and imperialist foreign policy of the United States has negative consequences for every aspect of life in the U.S. and abroad. As long as Americans are investing so much in the military, not only will Americans not have the money to invest in better things, but they are also exacerbating countless problems on a global level. In order to create the world Americans want and need, U.S. social movements must take up the struggle against militarism. Here are just ways that injustices in the U.S. are fueled by the war machine. Police violence is armed by the Pentagon. Since 1996, 1,033 program has been providing excess military equipment to police departments throughout the United States of America. A 2014 ACLU report titled War Comes Home found that militarized police act aggressively and violently, target black and brown communities, and kill Americans at an alarming tempo. This violence was shown explicitly when city police departments as well as federal police and the National Guard were deployed to tear gas, bludgeon, and kettle anti-racist protesters in 2020. Within the last year, we saw activists in Los Angeles and water protectors in the indigenous-led struggle to stop Line 3 from being subjected to similar militarized police suppression. The so-called war on terror has fueled the criminalization of immigrants. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has a massive surveillance database that it uses to track immigrants and immigrant rights activists. ICE is a direct product of the so-called war on terror, which eroded basic privacy rights and established some of the United States' most draconian anti-immigrant policies, which the Biden administration is maintaining. The so-called war on terror also ramped up the long-standing militarization of the United States-Mexico border and raids on immigrant communities. U.S. warmongering fuels hate. Last year, anti-Asian hate crimes in the United States jumped 339%. It is no coincidence that this spike happened as the United States was pushing a foreign policy of military containing China. Similar spikes in anti-Asian violence throughout the United States were prevalent when the United States was at war with Japan and waging a military invasion of Vietnam. During the height of the so-called War on Terror, similar racist violence and systematic racism were directed at Arab and South Asian communities. The U.S. military furthers settler colonial occupation of indigenous lands, from mining uranium and testing nuclear weapons on Navajo land to poisoning and harassing indigenous communities throughout the Pacific Lake in Hawaii and Okinawa, the U.S. military maintains colonial violence against indigenous peoples. Meanwhile, the U.S. continues to support apartheid, occupation, and ethnic cleansing in Palestine, giving the fake regime of Israel nearly $4 billion in aid just last year. The U.S. military is the world's largest institutional polluter in the world. The U.S. military is the world's largest oil consumer and causes more greenhouse gas emissions than 140 countries. Along with fossil fuel use, the U.S. military has harmed the environment by dumping toxic chemicals that poison communities throughout the United States. Yet, at COP26, militaries were exempt. Americans have publicly spent $21 trillion since 2001 on the Pentagon, and yet $4.5 trillion could fully decarbonize the U.S. electric grid. Student debt is a predatory trap used for military recruitment. The U.S. Army has outright bragged that it has been able to use the student debt crisis as a way to meet its recruitment goals. This predatory recruitment practice, which many characterize as a poverty draft, means that black, brown, and poor white communities are disproportionately more likely to enlist. When warfare is a priority, healthcare is not. Just like promises of debt cancellation, the military uses promises of healthcare to recruit vulnerable communities. Along with depriving people in the U.S. of healthcare to make military service more appealing, the U.S. imperialism deprives the world of healthcare by suppressing medical innovation if it comes from countries that don't align with U.S. imperialism, like Cuba and China. The military budget must go towards reparations for black, brown, and indigenous communities. Along with maintaining white supremacy and systems of oppression, the U.S. military continues to further bloat its budget every year, taking away wealth that could go towards reparations programs for racial equity. The United States owes reparations to countless communities, including payments to black communities for loss of generational wealth tied to slavery, land back to indigenous communities, and repayments to economies destroyed by the U.S. wars, such as Afghanistan. The military's constant hunger for more money is an obstacle to putting money towards reparations programs.
During the Vietnam War, the U.S. military engaged in an aggressive program of chemical warfare codenamed Operation Ranch Hand. Now, from 1961 to 1971, the U.S. military sprayed a range of herbicides across more than 4.5 million acres of Vietnam to destroy the forest cover and food crops used by North Vietnamese. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange, which contains the deadly chemical dioxin, was the most commonly used herbicide It was later proven to cause serious health issues, including cancer, birth defects, rashes, and severe psychological and neurological problems. But the Vietnamese were not the only ones affected. U.S. soldiers unknowingly brought the legacy of Agent Orange back home. Join us for this week's Aperture as we meet three children of U.S. veterans who fallen victim to Agent Orange and follow them as they travel to Vietnam to face their demons. Here's the first part.
All I ever heard was war stories about how horrible it was and how violent everything was and that there was just death and destruction. And that's the picture that was painted in my head of what Vietnam was. And it scared me half to death when I was getting ready to come over here, to the point where I was actually shaking on the plane on my way here because I did not know what to expect.
Traveling here, someone said, you know, Heather travels back to the land of her father's demons. Vietnam is still a very scary, dangerous place to them.
I was actually very nervous and very scared. Several of my father's friends kind of scared me about some of the things that I may see and hear and experience. Their vision of Vietnam was a war-torn, angry place.
Have any bottled water before we get going, just in case.
My name is Josh Kelly. I was born on August 18th, 1975.
My name is Heather Bowser. My maiden name is Morris.
My name is Rachel Harding. I was born in northern Indiana near Chicago.
My dad was Daniel Kelly. He was in the U.S. Marine Corps, and he fought in Vietnam.
My parents had married 9 days before he had left for Vietnam. They said that, you know, if they had 9 days being together, that's what they wanted to do.
My father got his draft papers when he turned 18 and chose to marry my mother before he left. They got married, and 2 weeks later, he was deployed to Vietnam.
I've been trying to find out what exactly happened when he was there, because when I was younger, I tried to block the stories out because some of them were so scary and so violent and all that, that I just tried to not even listen to them because I didn't want to hear it because they scared the bottom of me because I was just a kid.
Home, I'm coming home. No more marching and fighting for me. I am a soldier, a coming home soldier. No purple heart do I wear on my chest. I'm coming home, I'm coming.
When they came home, they wanted to put the war behind them. The Vietnam War was a very difficult political time, civil rights time, and so wanting to put it behind them, start their family and move on.
As soon as he came home, they chose to wait to have children. They waited about 7 years before they decided to try, and I was the firstborn.
The string's already broken, and he doesn't really care. It keeps changing fast. It don't last for long. It's the Colorado Rocky Mountain High.
So my mother had two miscarriages. She lost two children. And no one in our family had had any kind of problems in that respect. So it was very unexpected. And then in 1972, My mother was pregnant again and felt that she had gone into labor early. She was not due for a while. They went to the hospital. She had already lost two children, so she was very scared. She thought she might be miscarrying again at a very late time in the pregnancy. They rushed her into the hospital, and she said, I'm in labor. And she was very thin, and they kind of said, no, you're okay. It's okay. You're going to be all right. You're not in labor. You barely look pregnant. She was 7 months along at that point. My mother woke up to my father sitting at her bedside telling her, and it's hard to talk about, but he said, Sharon, she's damaged. And that's what she woke up to. So I can only imagine how scary that was.
The doctors, as soon as I was born, they took me from my mom and they put me in a little incubator, and then they rushed me off out of the room. They didn't explain anything to my mom. They just said that there was problems.
Various doctors approached my mother at different times and asked what she had done to her child. What had she done to cause such terrible problems?
They brought her over to show me to her for about 5 minutes, and then they put me on an airplane and they flew me to another state, and they kept me in the incubator. And they put me in intensive care, and they had all kinds of doctors looking at me and checking to see if I was going to live or die or what the deal was, because missing my arms and my leg, they weren't sure what all was wrong with me. They started to take me to the doctors and stuff out there, and because they were big hospitals and there was lots of doctors from around the world and everything, they wanted to try a whole bunch of different surgeries and stuff that were like experimental surgeries that nobody had ever tried before. Like, one of them was that they wanted to grow my arms back, and the way that they were going to do it is they were going to cut the skin open, break the bone, and then they were going to drill holes through it and put screws in it and put plates to separate the bone, and the bone would grow in between the gaps. And they said that it could take up to 5 to 10 years for my arms to finish growing back, and that it would be an extremely painful.
I want to go back to real quick to one memory I had in kindergarten. We were learning about our hands. This is your left hand, this is your right hand. And it's always a memory that I kind of laugh about. I love school. I couldn't wait to go to school. I was so excited. I wanted to read and do that stuff. So we're sitting in this circle, and the little children are sitting there, and I can just remember this to this day. And there was like a board on the floor, and it had a picture, an outline of a hand and another hand. And each child was to go around and take their turn and say, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, this is my left hand, this is my right hand. And so I remember just being anxious and excited to do my turn. And I went to put my hand in, and I just, at that moment, I was like, oh, okay. Because they had the outline, and my fingers didn't match the outline. And I was like, okay, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, but they don't look like that left hand and that right hand. And that was kind of like, okay, I'm different. That's different.
Pretty much all my life, as far back as I can remember, I knew I was different, because I was always going to the doctors, and I would always see the other kids playing and stuff, and I couldn't really go play with them because I either had doctor's appointments or they didn't want anything to do with me.
I have lost 19 children. I never carried more longer than 8.5 weeks, and I would lose my children. I have hypothyroidism, the infertility issue, and psoriatic arthritis. Those are the three biggest ones that I have that affect my life personally. And my family could not understand, my father included, could not understand, where did this come from? Nobody else in the family's ever had this. How come you're suffering from this and nobody else ever has?
I've seen lots of different kids that had disabilities and stuff, from being like in the in the hospitals and stuff all the time, and some of them are so similar that it would have to be from the same thing. The similarities in our disabilities are so much alike. There's no way to deny that it was the same thing that caused both of them.
These are the structural formulas for 2,4-dichlorophenoxyacetic acid, commonly known as 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. From these chemicals are made a large number of closely related compounds, which are sold commercially for weed and brush control. The Secretary of Defense initiated a project to determine whether visibility in troublesome jungle vegetation in the Republic of Vietnam could be improved by aerially applied chemical sprays. In that country, jungle growth, swamp foliage, and roadside vegetation retains its leaves the year around. Consequently, it affords ideal concealment to guerrilla terrorists who sporadically attack the free people of Vietnam. As a result of these tests, defoliation spraying was placed on an operational basis. Those chemicals already proven most effective as defoliants will continue to be used until faster acting types.
So my father says that he said that there was spraying of his base pretty regularly. I found out since that his base was practically sprayed every day, and that is also due to its proximity to Benoit. Benoit was the epicenter of where Ranch Hand worked out of. So if they had anything left on their missions, they came around that area and used it. The perimeter was hand sprayed, aerial spraying with the C-123 planes.
My dad was in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was stationed in the Chu Lai Air Base. And while he was there, he was exposed to lots of Agent Orange. They sprayed it on everything. It was in the food, it was in the water, it was on their clothes, it was on the plants, it was on the guns, the ammo, everything had Agent Orange on it. So he was heavily exposed to Agent Orange.
North Vietnam charged today that defoliants have produced many instances of miscarriages, congenital defects, and monstrosities among children.
As we anticipated, the Vietnamese doctors that we've met with very much share our concerns about the effects of Agent Orange.
Although that war was long ago, there is lingering anger about the United States' use of a controversial defoliant spread by American aircraft on the jungles there.
Milton Ross, a special forces advisor near Pleiku, has a son born without the tips of his fingers.
Frank Moore is nearly dead from cancer. He thinks the cancer was caused by chemical defoliants he was exposed to as a soldier in Vietnam.
My dad explained to me about how dangerous the stuff was because it would kill off big old trees and everything in just a couple of days. He would tell me the stories about how he would have to mix it and he would have to load it into the tanks and he would put the tanks on the planes and the helicopters and everything while he was in the war.
It's still causing trouble and all of the people that have lost their lives to Agent Orange, and this is kind of where it began. So it's very sad.
We found out that the rate of miscarriages, fetal death in utero, and birth defects are 4 times higher than in the exposed, among the exposed, than the non-exposed. We have carried out some more studies. I'm now very sure, certain, that toxic chemicals cause many things to my people, to the exposed people. Cannot deny.
Yes, exactly.
Cannot deny the relationship between dioxin with the abnormal outcome of pregnancy, among the exposed people.
After the war time, after 75, his dad came back here and they have the first child. But due to the Asian race, she or he died after 10 days. The biggest biggest child of the family is a normal child because he was born before the time that the dad came to the army.
But do you know in America who carries the pain of Agent Orange? The veterans who serve. The veterans feel responsible.
Yes.
Our fathers felt responsible for us. Even for in Vietnam. I mean, they felt responsible. The soldier, not the chemical companies or the government that made the decisions.
So my father felt extreme guilt. He felt like he had caused my birth defects. He had told my mother that every time he looked at me, he felt that it was his responsibility. He had caused this to me. And that's a major problem in the United States, trying to work through the Agent Orange issue, is that the veterans feel extreme guilt.
The man that my mom knew from the time she was four did not come home from Vietnam. He's still wandering around in the jungle somewhere. He came home a very angry man, very sad man.
My dad was suffering more and more from his PTSD. He was having other health issues and he was getting weak, and he couldn't do the things that he could do before, and his health was just going downhill.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
زیارت قدیر. In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. Salam, dear listeners. Here is the second part of the memorable ziyara of Qadir, or standard form of salutation to the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the first part of which we presented to you yesterday. Stay tuned. My master, your excellence cannot be hidden, and your light cannot be extinguished, and those who repudiate you are the most unjust and wretched of creatures. My master, you are Allah's testament to his servants, and his guide to rectitude, and a provision for the day of resurrection. My master, Allah has certainly exalted your station in this world, and elevated your rank in the hereafter, and he enabled you to perceive that to which your opponents were blind, and who became an obstacle between you and Allah's gifts to you. May Allah's curse be on those who violated your sanctity and usurped your right, and I affirm that they were the greatest losers. The fire will scorch their faces, and they will be morose in it. I testify that you never advanced, nor stepped back, nor spoke, nor were silent, except by the command of Allah and His Prophet. And you said, "By Him in whose hand is my soul, the Messenger of Allah, may Allah bless him and his household, saw me striking with the sword at the battlefront," whereupon he said to me, "O Ali, your position in relation to me is that of Aaron in relation to Moses, except that there shall be no prophet after me. I am informing you that your life and death is with me and in accordance with my sunnah." By Allah, I do not lie, nor what I have been told is a lie. Neither have I gone astray, nor have I been misled, nor have I forgotten the pledge my Lord has given me. Indeed, I am on a manifest proof from my Lord, which he has clarified for his Prophet, and the Prophet has clarified it for me, and I am indeed on a clear road, word by word. By Allah, what you have said is true, and by Allah, what you have stated is the truth. So may Allah's curse be upon those who equate you with those who dissociated themselves from you. Allah may glory be to His name, says, "Are those who know equal to those who do not know?" May Allah's curse be on those who equate you with those who were obligated by Allah to submit to your wilaya. You are Allah's wali, brother of his prophet, and defender of his religion, and you are the one whose merit has been declared by the Quran. Allah the Most High has said, "And Allah has graced those who wage jihad over those who sit back with a great reward, ranks from him, forgiveness and mercy, and Allah is all-forgiving, all-merciful." And Allah the Most High has said, "Do you regard the providing of water to Hajj pilgrims and the maintenance of the holy mosque as similar in worth to someone who has faith in Allah and believes in the last day and wages jihad in the way of Allah? They are not equal with Allah, and Allah does not guide the wrongdoing lot. Those who have believed and migrated and waged jihad in the way of Allah with their possessions and persons have a greater rank near Allah, and it is they who are the triumphant. Their Lord gives them the good news of His mercy and His pleasure, and for them there will be gardens with lasting bliss to remain in them forever. With Allah indeed is a great reward." "I testify that you were singled out by Allah for acclaim. You were exclusively dedicated to obeying Allah, never seeking any substitute for guidance, and never associating anyone in the worship of your Lord, and that Allah the Most High answered regarding you the prayer of His Prophet, may Allah bless him and his family, and then commanded him to proclaim that which He had bestowed upon you for the sake of His Ummah, in order to exalt your station, to promulgate your testament, to refute falsehoods, and to preclude all excuses. So when He was apprehensive of the seditions of the evildoers and was wary of the hypocrites on your account, the Lord of the worlds revealed to Him, O Prophet, proclaim that which has been sent down to you from your Lord, and if you do not, you will not have conveyed His message, and Allah shall protect you from the evil of the people." Thereupon he made the caravan halt and bring down its burdens in mid-journey, and rose in the intense heat of the day of Ghadir to deliver a sermon, calling upon them to listen and crying out to them to communicate Allah's edicts. Then he asked their assembly, "Have I delivered?" They said, "Yes, indeed." Whereat he said, "Allah be witness." Then he said, "Am I not more entitled to direct the affairs of the faithful than themselves?" They answered, "Yes, indeed." Then he took your hand and declared, "Of whomever I am master and guardian, this Ali is his master and guardian. O Allah, befriend those who befriend him, and be the enemy of those who are his enemies. Help those who help him, and forsake those who forsake him." Yet none except a few believed in what Allah had revealed concerning you, and it did not increase the majority of them except in loss. Indeed, Allah had formerly revealed concerning you something which they regarded with aversion. O you who have faith, should any of you desert his religion, Allah will soon bring a people whom he loves and who love him, who will be humble towards the faithful, stern towards the faithless, waging jihad in the way of Allah, not fearing the blame of any blamer. That's Allah's grace which He grants to whomever He wishes, and Allah is all bounteous, all knowing. Your guardian is only Allah, His Prophet, and the faithful who maintain the prayer and give the zakat while bowing down. Whoever takes for his guardians Allah, his Prophet, and the faithful should know that the Hizbullah are indeed the victorious.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. The next recommendation is that you should reveal the enemy's lies, deceptions, and psychological warfare. At the time of Imam, there was no internet, nor did satellites exist in this form. In those days, Imam used to say that the enemy fought against us with his pen. Imam was aware of this. Today, the issue is not about pens, rather it is about cyberspace, satellites, and psychological warfare. One that is comprehensive and rampant everywhere. You should not let the enemy's psychological warfare impact the country. Let me cite a small example of psychological warfare. They stole our oil on Greek shores. Then our self-sacrificing and valiant soldiers made up for it and confiscated the enemy's ship carrying oil. Then the enemy accused Iran to theft via his comprehensive propaganda and media empire. Who is a thief? You stole our oil. We took it back from you. Taking back stolen property is not theft. It is you who are thieves.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Americans order the Greek government, and they obey by stealing our oil. Well, these are instances of psychological warfare. You should confront such psychological warfare, examples of which occur every day. The next recommendation is that you must make the most of the people's faith for producing good deeds. The people are pious and have faith. This faith can produce good actions. You can do this. Our magnanimous Imam was a master at this. Imam was a genius in making the most of the people's faith for producing good deeds. The next recommendation is that you should not let some people pretend that the country has reached a dead end. This is some people's job right now in cyberspace. Now some individuals do it out of negligence or they are paid to do it. I do not know, but they want to pretend that the country has reached a dead end. No! The country will not reach a dead end. This happened at the time of Imam too. At that time, some people wrote in newspapers that the country had reached a dead end. Imam said, no, it is you who reached the dead end. The Islamic Republic will not reach a dead end. He said that it was they who had reached a dead end. This is the truth of the matter.
Allah, I wanna thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The EU's tourism industry is currently thriving, but make no mistake, businesses facing huge overheads are struggling to turn a profit. In its summer economic forecast, the European Commission has revised growth downwards and inflation upwards. The bloc is concerned Russia is going to turn off all its gas supplies.
This risk has become more than just a hypothetical scenario for which we need to prepare. So a storm is possible.
For millions, the storm is already here. Governments are accused of not providing support to deal with the cost of living crisis arising from sanctions against Russia, but can find money for other causes. The EU is providing 9 billion euro to Ukraine to run the country and has sent a separate 2 billion for military equipment. This is in addition to the huge amounts of money being spent on Ukraine by individual member states, most of whom are in NATO, where military spending is also increasing. Not to mention the EU is developing its own army. Citizens say fueling the Ukraine war is costing the EU too much.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful. But, you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Yes, of course we need to end the war, but the problem is nobody knows how to end the war, you know.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, has been facing pressure during a visit to the European Parliament.
NATO, along with the US and the EU, were never a defensive mechanism, not before the war and not after it. They are offensive. Ukraine has been sacrificed for their interests.
Experts warn the growing social crisis in the EU will have dire consequences for the political establishment. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have condemned U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to occupied Palestine. Scores of people in the blockaded enclave protested against Biden's visit while shouting slogans in support of resistance actions against the occupying regime. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Tel Aviv on Wednesday to kick off his first trip to the region since taking office. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas accused Joe Biden of putting the interests of the Israeli regime ahead of the legitimate rights of Palestinians and regional security.
The President of the United States of America carries nothing but unlimited support for the Zionist entity, its security and prosperity, and a package of false promises to the Palestinians.